Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As parents, inevitably we've said it at some point. You see your son or daughter reading what appears to us to be material of questionable value, and we say as we walk by, "Why are you reading that junk?" Well, my guest says we should resist that urge. He says, in fact, research is telling us that nearly all reading is beneficial. Even the most inane material, in our view, is providing imaginative pleasures, sparking profound questions, and helping adolescents discover their place in the world and foster their aspirations. Educational researchers Michael Smith and Jeffrey Wilhelm looked at the pleasure reading choices of adolescent eighth graders and found that they were doing important thematic work, speaking sophisticatedly about their reading with their peers, and using the material to inspire their sense of self, beliefs, and dreams. Their book is titled Reading Unbound: Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them, and reminds teachers and parents that nearly all reading is good for the intellect and the soul. Michael Smith is a professor in the College of Education at Temple University, a former high school teacher for 11 years, written a wide variety of articles and contributing chapters in over a dozen books. In fact, the two have also previously collaborated on Reading Don't Fix No Chevys, Literacy in the Lives of Young Men, which was an award-winning book. And he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Professor Smith, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
I know a lot of your work with your colleague Jeffrey Wilhelm has looked at how students read and the importance of reading. And, of course, there's been this sort of new reaction that I think from political education circles that we need to be very choice on what kids read. And I think your book, Reading Unbound, suggests that, in fact, the opposite is the case.
Yes, that's right. Well, we found it was that regardless of what kids were reading, when they chose to read something, they were doing really serious work with it, and it was doing really serious work for them.
Now, how would you define serious work?
In a number of different ways. I mean, some kids read texts because they were thinking about becoming an author, so they were writing fanfics or whatever they were, you know, that sort of work. But what was most moving to us in talking with the young readers that we talked with how they used their reading to think about the kind of people they wanted to become and how they could become those people.
You refer to that as inner work pleasure. Is that correct?
Yes.
Explain what inner work pleasure is in reading.
By inner work, we mean the deeply psychological work that people do to become themselves, if you will, to establish their identities in the world. And we found that kids use their reading to do that. So here's one of my favorite quotes. One kid, her name in the book is Helen. She said, "Sometimes when big stuff happens in my life, I think about what my favorite characters would have done, the ones I admire most. They all have different approaches, different ways they approach things. And then I try to apply that to my life to see which way works for me. Characters are just ways of thinking, really." That's a pretty profound statement from an eighth grader.
It was. And so they're reading, you know, stories that sort of give them, you know, a lot of young adult fiction has this moral compass sort of as a part of the story. And a lot of that is reflected. And it doesn't matter if it's a romance or, I think that's the interesting thing, is you're talking, if the kids are reading, let them read.
That's what we would say, and for teachers and parents, be respectful of the reading that they're doing, and try to understand what they're taking from that. Nobody reads something if they're not getting something from that act, right? So we want teachers and parents to think more deeply about the importance of reading pleasure and trying to cultivate that and respecting that.
Now, I don't know if it's still controversial or not. It was certainly a few years ago, and that was the idea of reading graphic novels or anime or graphic text.
Yes.
Is there any sense that it's doing the same good benefit as any other sort of reading?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. One of the things that was interesting, we did when we were doing the study, our research assistant, Sharon Franzen, at one point wrote in a research memo, is that the interviews that she was reading changed completely her belief or her beliefs about those sorts of graphic texts. I mean, it was amazing when the kids talked about, one kid talked about he read his graphic text more slowly because he had to read both the words and read the pictures. And they were doing really complicated stuff with those texts. So one of the lessons that I'm taking from this is that even simple texts, have the capacity to engage kids in really sophisticated interpretive work.
You know, if we can follow up on the whole idea of illustration, in the 20s and 30s, the classic stories, you know, whether it was Treasure Island, Tom Sawyer, you know, all these classics that we consider classics of literature, almost always kids were reading them in illustrated versions where there would be a illustration at the end of the chapter or an illustration in the middle of the chapter. That was a fairly common practice. Do you think we lost something in kids' books by sort of saying, oh, illustrations, well, we don't need that in our text?
Well, what we found in this book, I was surprised by how sophisticated the kids were in talking about reading illustrations. In other work we've done, Jeff and I have argued that that illustrations, that visual text sort of scaffold, they provide support for readers who are sometimes having difficulty. We underestimated, until this study, the way that kids engaged in doing that kind of reading, you know, and a critical reading of the illustrations that accompanied the texts that they were engaged with. If you think about, you know, as kids really have maybe a more sophisticated aesthetic sense than my generation does about the power of illustrations because of games. And, you know, the video games, obviously the visual is a huge part of that. So they're bringing something, they're bringing more sophistication in on the visual aspect of text than I certainly did when I was growing up.
So they're reading a text and they're seriously visualizing the scene in their mind.
They're both visualizing the scene in their mind, and if someone else's visualization is there, they're thinking about that and they're critiquing that. That point about visualizing is what we call play pleasure. And one of the things that we found that kids really deeply entered the story worlds that they were reading about, so much so that they could see them and smell them and feel them and really experience those worlds in some kind of way. One of the powers of narratives is that they're both fictional narratives, is that they're both real and unreal at the same time, if you see what I'm saying. So kids can try stuff out in those worlds in sort of a safe environment, and that's when I think part of the both the pleasure of reading resolves, but also the benefits that you can get from reading.
You know, I think a lot of people do underestimate that idea of play pleasure. The fact that you're entering this other world and you're getting a great deal of enjoyment. You're visualizing, you're sort of thinking ahead to what's going to happen in the story, and you're sort of imagining things as you're reading it. I think that's one of the great pleasures in a day and age when, you know, we are always lamenting the fact that kids are not doing imaginative play. Maybe imaginative play with reading is perhaps the one outlet they have.
Yes, I think that they do. I think that they actually get that sort of in their videos too. We call it, drawing on a quote from Santayana, we call it living through, or yes, actually Kenneth Burke, sorry, that reading provide imaginative rehearsals for living. So it's not just that they're imagining it, they're actually engaged in it. And that's part of the pleasure that people get from reading, but it's also part of the power that reading has, because it really allows you to feel the stuff that you're going through as you read.
Now, one of the other things you found was that text complexity could vary greatly in a lot of these books, but what you found was that the kids were also sort of putting in an interpretive complexity to what they were reading, no matter the amount of the text complexity. In fact, sometimes they were making it more complex in their interpretations when it was simpler.
That's absolutely true. So with the Common Core State Standards, one of the big moves is to have kids reading more complicated texts. And we want people to think not only about textual complexity, but also interpretive complexity, and recognize the kind of this sort of deep work that you were just mentioning that kids do with texts. Now we argue that if we take pleasure seriously, if teachers take pleasure seriously, they're going to want to have both engage kids in reading texts that they're likely to find pleasurable, but also that they can expand the range of texts in which kids can take pleasure. So we think that there's, you know, we want both sides, teachers to be working on both sides of the coin, if you see what I'm saying.
Right. So hopefully in the curriculum, there'll be time for strictly pleasurable reading as well as sort of the required reading, and hopefully you're putting the required list in a way that is pleasurable.
Right, and creating conversation between the two of them. When one of my daughters was a senior in high school, I sat in on the English teacher, you know, on back to school night, and the English teacher rattled off the books that they were reading in the class and said, well, because they're going to hate all of this reading, we show a lot of movies. And I almost wilted right there in my seat. So that's not the way to cultivate lifelong readers. And being a lifelong reader, we've been persuasive evidence recently published. It has enormous benefits.
You know, I've heard some really interesting curriculum ideas where you meld like mythology, traditional mythologies, with something like, say, Harry Potter or something like that. Is that what you're talking about?
That would be one example, yes.
Or maybe epics. Maybe that's a better way to think of that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. With one word of warning, which is that one of the things that we found was that kids had strong preferences for particular kinds of reading, and those preferences varied. So that's why we think that choice is so important in schools. So presuming that because it's Harry Potter, kids are going to like it, might not be the case. But bringing Harry Potter into the classroom, I think, is an excellent idea. But also providing choice for students so that the students for whom Harry Potter was not the best choice can make their own choices and create the sort of textual conversations that we were talking about before.
My guest today is Michael Smith, a professor in the College of Education at Temple University. He and his colleague Jeffrey Wilhelm are the authors of Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read, What They Want, and Why We Should Let Them. Now, let me ask you, how did you go about learning what kids are reading, and what sort of things are kids reading? I think you were sort of looking at middle school years, I believe, for the most part, right?
Well, our study had two parts. In the first part, we surveyed eighth graders as to whether kids were avid readers outside of class. And we were particularly interested in the genres that tend to be marginalized in school. So we asked kids if they were readers of romance, vampire stories, dystopian fiction like The Hunger Games, horror, and fantasy. So we asked about those, and then we interviewed all the kids who said yes. That was stage one of our work. Stage two, and what we tried to do is we tried to think about looking across those different kinds of readers, what we could say they had in common, the kinds of pleasure they had in common across the kinds of reading that they did. The second phase of the study, we did case studies of each of those different genres. So we looked in depth at committed readers of romance, committed readers of vampire fiction, and tried to understand the pleasure that they took from their particular brand of reading. So the first half of the book is about sort of what happened across readers and different kinds of reading, and the second half of the book is about focusing one at a time on these genres that tend to be, at least people, teachers and parents tend to be at least a little bit suspicious of.
Let me ask you, because you know, most of those categories are a trend of the last couple of decades for the most part. But romance, I think teachers have been confiscating romance novels since, you know, probably the early 30s or 40s.
Right, right.
What are the benefits of those romance novels to the child that's reading them?
It's really interesting because romance novels are, when I was a high school teacher, I used to shudder when I started with Sweet Valley High, you know, those kinds of things. And what they get out of them, when we did the case study, is that they used the romance novels as a way to think about the kind of relationships they wanted to have. Our informant, the young woman we work with, especially about romances, she made a big distinction between what she thought were fake romances and real romances. And real romances are when people had hurdles to overcome in developing a relationship. So here's something she says. What was satisfying to me in this relationship was that he became more fully himself, more active, more dominant, and he realizes this new personal growth is because of being with her. So you see, they're looking for mutually supportive growth, and the romance helped her articulate this her reading of romances helped her articulate that that was an aim that she wanted to have in the relationships that she would enter.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, my guest today is Michael Smith. He's co-author of the new book, Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned there's several other pleasures that come from this unstructured reading. One is intellectual pleasure. Describe what you mean by intellectual pleasure. Is this like you're learning new things, the idea of reading for reading's sake? Is this what we consider the traditional learning that we do when we read?
Well, some of that that you said at the beginning, we would call the pleasure of work. That is, if I'm if we had one kid who read because he was a blogger, so he read just as you obviously read our book to have this interview. He read in order to post stuff, and we had kids talking about, or they were writing fanfics, and so they had to read in the genre because they were writing in the genre. So that's one kind of work. What we meant by intellectual pleasures is that the sort of pleasure of figuring out a puzzle, and that is the kind of pleasure that's characteristically most valued in school. You know, how do you kids get sort of thematic understandings? The kids talked in large measure about that, about figuring things out, figuring how things went together, understanding how authors did what they did. So they did take pleasure in doing that, and we don't, which is important to me as a teacher, because that's some of the stuff that I want to help them learn how to do as an English teacher.
Did you find that, like, when they're reading a vampire story, they're sort of applying the same sort of thematical analysis that they would, say, if they were reading a short story by Ray Bradbury in the classroom?
Yes. It was really interesting. And what they said, though, was that in schools, they tended to know what the teacher wanted them to see instead of letting them see what they were going to see, if you see what I'm saying. So that there was a bit of trying to guess what's on the teacher's mind that actually undermined the intellectual pleasure that they took from their school reading.
And perhaps the teacher is steering them in the direction they want them to go, too.
Absolutely.
So in this case, they're actually doing the intellectual work really completely on their own.
Yes. Although they did it with friends very often. So, one of the other kinds of pleasure that we talk about is social pleasure. And we found that these avid readers tended to have friendship groups that were readers of similar kinds of text. That wasn't always the case, but it was often the case.
Well, and that last idea of pleasure, we've seen this manifested in a lot of different ways, from the Hunger Games to the Harry Potter books. This whole idea of the social network that develops around a series of books, that's a really important benefit to take from reading. It explains why we have, you know, reading groups today as adults.
Yeah. I've been in reading groups my whole adult life, and I've been in one now for the one in Philadelphia that I've been in is coming on 20 years, and a couple of the people in the club I've been friendly with outside the club, but a couple of the people in the club, a number of people in the club, I see only at our meetings, but I consider them among my closest friends because the stuff we talk about is the stuff that's most central to my life. I mean, we're really talking about working together to try to understand some big issues. And that does develop relationships, I think.
Do you find that the eighth graders are forging their own relationships from reading as well?
Without question. Both friends and family. If there were one of my favorite little parts that we talk about in the book is this young woman who would, she, every week, I think it was after a lesson, her dad would pick her up at her music lesson or something like that, and she'd have a book with her. And they'd stop on the way home to get something to eat. And every week the joke was the father would say, well, should we talk like normal human beings or should we, and she'd interrupt him and say, shut up and read, Dad, and then laugh. But it was a standing joke. And there was, it's such a sweet scene, you know, they're sharing this passion for reading. One that I really identified with because when I was growing up, my dad was sickly. And one of the ways that we spent time together is he sat in his chair reading his book, and I sat in my chair reading my book. And we weren't even speaking, but we were together in that act of reading. So part of my love of reading is strongly related to my love of my dad.
Well, let's look at the takeaways for parents and teachers from this research. What do parents and teachers need to keep in mind about their students and children's reading habits, and as far as helping to foster them?
Well, one of our big takeaways is that we need to respect and try to understand why kids make the reading choices that they make. We did not find a single example of kids read what they need to read. And as I said, I think when we started, the reading that they were doing was important to them in a wide variety of ways. So, you know, and if I'm thinking back to 1976 when I started teaching, and when I was shuddering at Sweet Valley High, I was, truth be told, I was sort of having a superior attitude towards my students reading, not thinking about that they must be having some value for them, and trying to understand what that value was. So that's one thing that we would want teachers and parents to take away. Another one is that we shouldn't make such a big divide between pleasure reading and school reading. The bigger that gap is, I think the less kids are going to embrace that kind of reading that they're asked to do in school. Part of that means we should be mindful of the pleasure that we want kids to take in that school reading. We shouldn't have a cod liver oil approach to teaching, and this is going to be good for you in the future. It might taste terrible now, but rather we should think deeply and all the time about having kids creating contexts in classrooms where kids can experience this rich variety of pleasure that they do in their out-of-school reading.
And for parents, you're reading junk. That's probably a phrase that should be forbidden from their vocabulary.
Yes, because even the junk has a nutritional value, we found. Yeah, well, there's been regularly, I've had parents tell me, another book that Jeff and I did is called Reading Don't Fix No Chevys, Literacy in the Lives of Young Men. And especially around the publication of that book, we might do a talk at a library or something like that, and parents would come after me and say, I really wish my son would read. I just can't get him to take his nose out of his Sports Illustrated, or even there are a lot of text-based video games, and so they were doing reading. Now we think there's a particular kind of pleasure that comes from reading books, and we want to encourage that, but we don't want to dismiss. We want to build bridges between the kinds of texts that kids embrace and the ones that we want them to read.
And, great sports books, whether it's Plimpton or maybe that's the entree for the kid that loves sports.
It might be, but it might not be the great sports books. When I was telling the story about my dad reading, I read a book called Danger in 23rd Street Crusaders, which is a book about a basketball team in a CYO league. And I probably read it 35 times when I was in seventh grade. I would read it, and I'd start reading it right from the beginning. Now, that was not... I loved that book. I don't know if it'd be on anybody's list of the 10 greatest sports books ever, but I've read some of those. It might have been my, stepping down, taking the first... steps down a path that would lead me to those other books.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really interesting book, Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. There's an interesting article in the Atlantic magazine about the book as well. Michael Smith, thanks very much for joining us.
I really appreciate talking to you. Thanks.
Michael Smith is a professor at the College of Education at Temple University. He and his colleague Jeffrey Wilhelm are the authors of Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. It's published by Scholastic. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
I want to tell you about these four couples. Couple number one, my neighbors. I was walking outside. She was sitting on the porch. They just moved in. What are you doing? I asked. I should stay away from staple guns. We'll get along fine, I said. Next morning, they sat outside in the backyard, drinking coffee, smiling, arms around each other, petting their big dog, as it turned out, a loud dog. Stephen King loud. I looked at them through the window. We should get a dog, I said to Melissa, my girlfriend. You don't like dogs. Point taken. Couple number two. Melissa's sister Amy lives in a trailer in Yukon. She has a son, Grayer. That's his name. Don't judge. Grayer, who's always smiling. Strangest thing, like he's in on an inside joke. Amy, too, always smiling, and now pregnant again. Two babies soon, in diapers, in a trailer, in Yukon. Don't judge. The photos of the three of them. Soon the four of them, on blankets, on chairs, inside the trailer. It's beautiful. Couple number three. When she was single, we sat at a comedy club once, a bar, and talked of my first ex-wife, and then she showed me pictures of her new love. It didn't look right. They didn't fit. She told me years later when we were out on our only date, I tried kissing her. I don't remember that, but it sounds like me. Now, new pictures of her and her new love. This one seems right. You can tell by how they lean into each other. Couple number four. Laura and I met on Facebook, if you can call meeting on Facebook, meeting. We agree on Elizabeth Warren. We agree on the seediness that was Urban Tulsa Weekly. We agree on the insanity in Oklahoma City. Laura reposts my stuff. I repost hers. She's smarter than I am, but thank God she doesn't make a thing about it. She's married, commutes to Stillwater twice a week. We're going to have dinner soon, the four of us. Melissa and I are going to have to study because this is a smart, savvy couple, and we're not ready. Okay, so you're probably asking, I know I would be, what's the point here? So you have neighbors, so you like them, so they're not good around staple guns, so they have discriminating tastes, so they live in trailers, so they have trouble, had trouble finding love. So, my neighbors are just the same way. You're right. There's nothing unique here, except that which we make unique. Love and marriage and dinner plans. Oh, they're lesbians. All four couples. As I said, there's nothing special about this. Nothing at all.
Barry Friedman is a writer, a stand-up comic, and a columnist at the New Tulsa Voice, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. You can search through our archives, look for some old shows if you missed a portion of the interview. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks so much for listening.